Hello, everybody. My name is Daniel Moth, and I'd like to welcome you to the second session of the multi-core track. As you can see on the screens, there are four more sessions after this one, so please take down the notes. I wouldn't want you to miss out on something that really interests you and you just happen to miss it in the schedule earlier. For example, after lunch, Stephen Taube is going to talk about how to take advantage of parallelism in .NET, and that session, I believe, is entirely in Visual Studio, so you don't want to miss that. But now you're here to learn how to take advantage of parallelism in C++. From Don McCready. So Don has been at Microsoft for 12 years as a developer in teams including the Workflow Foundation, BizTalk Server, and Complus services. Currently, he's the dev lead of the Concurrency Runtime and Parallel Pattern Library. Prior to Microsoft, he spent 8 years at IBM in Canada and holds a BSc from University of Alberta. And his hobbies include teaching pool, although I don't think he's won a tournament yet with his team, and astrophotography, which if you come to Building 40 on the fifth floor, you see some amazing photos outside his office. So with that, I'll hand it over to Don. Let's welcome him with an applause.
Thanks very much. Is my microphone working? All right, good. So this talk is going to be talking about how to use parallelism to realize performance improvements using C++ in your native programming apps. I'm going to talk about some things that my team produced in Visual Studio 2010, some things that are directly related to parallelism, parallel iteration, reducing shared state, asynchronous agents using message passing and some concurrent containers. I am going to start off by talking about something that's not related at all to concurrency, but something that was really cool and incredibly useful that was introduced in C++ in 2010, VS 2010, which really made our programming model usable. So mostly concurrency, but some background info, you might say. So I am going to start out this presentation with a demo just to kind of whet your appetite about the kinds of things that are that can be done. If I can find my... And this is a video that I took because the demo doesn't demo well over TS. So let me just get this started, and I'm going to start it in a loop and just talk to it. This is an N-body simulation. As you can see, there's 4,096 bodies floating around there under mutual gravitational influence. And this is running on a single core right now. And as you can see, you know, it could probably stand some performance improvement, although it's not bad. Kind of choppy, but not bad. One of the reasons that it's not bad is that even though it's running on a CPU right now, it's still running in parallel. That's because there's some mutual gravitational computations going on that are operating on an X, Y, and Z coordinate for each particle. And some really smart guy did that using the core's SSE instruction set. So those operations are going on in parallel, even on a single CPU. But the machine that I'm running this on right now, or took the video on, has 8 cores. And each one of those 8 cores has an SSE unit. So I have a potential parallelism here of 24. I'd really like to achieve that by using the other 7 cores. So this is what this looks like. I don't know why my hotkey isn't working. So we're starting out in single core mode, and I'm going to switch it to multi-core. You can see that I've realized an immediate and quite impressive, substantial performance improvement. It's a lot smoother when I drag it around. The particles move more smoothly. There's less jerkiness. And in fact, although I don't show it, I could probably crank up the particle count to 8,000 or 16,000 and it'd still be pretty smooth and performant. So I'm going to actually show you how I did that in a moment. But first, I'm going to proceed with my presentation. Actually, before I get to that, you can look at this background here. Daniel said that I'm into astrophotography. This is one of my pictures. And there's a lot of processing, as you can imagine, that goes on between taking a raw data out of a camera and producing something like this. And the program, one of the programs that I use to process this is called Images Plus. It's written by a really smart guy named Mike, lives in Minnesota. But he claims in his advertising material that his program is multi-core aware. So I'm using it, and I'm doing some filter, and I look at my CPU monitor, and I see that it's only using one core out of the four that I have. So I go to this conference, and I talk to this guy, and I said, I thought your program was multi-core aware. He goes, well, it is, because you can load up an image and do some long filter process, and in parallel, you can load up another image and do another parallel, filter operation in parallel. So, you know, there's a little education that I had to give him there. That's not multi-core or parallel programming. That's forcing me to be a multi-core parallel programmer. And this here is a single core, which is frequently preempted. So this is the goal that we're trying to achieve. And I showed him how he can actually change his code to achieve a picture like this. This is a snapshot of a program running Microsoft Concurrency Runtime on a 64-way machine, and this is what we love to see. 100% of the computing capability of the machine maxed out. In this case, it's 64 cores. Now, Windows 7 64-bit supports up to 256 cores. And if you were to code to the Win32 programming model, it's very, well, it's not impossible, but affinitizing the threads properly to all 256 cores is something that is not easy to do. There's new APIs introduced in Windows 7. You want your code to still run on Windows 6, you know, previous versions of Windows of the 32-bit version, which only still has a max of 64 cores. With Concert, if you program to the concurrency runtime, you can scale to the max that the OS allows, which on Win 7 64-bit is 256 cores. So let me talk a little bit about the concurrency runtime. It comes with Visual Studio 2010. It's part of the window of the C++ runtime. In other words, you don't have to link in any new libraries to get it. All you have to do is include the header files for the declarations, link it, compile it, link it, and go. It comes with two high-level programming models, which is what I'm going to be talking about this morning. One of them is called the PPL, which is short for Parallel Pattern Library. And the other one is Asynchronous Agents, which is more of a message passing model. Both these models work very well together. You can use one style, the other style, or both together if you want. The concurrency runtime using these two programming models that we expose at a high level abstracts away the notion of coding directly to threads, creating your own threads, scheduling your own work on threads. We manage it all seamlessly under the covers. Instead, we want you to think of tasks. And tasks are simply a unit of work that could potentially be run in parallel with other units of work. In other words, many tasks. And it's Concert's job to spread those tasks amongst all your available computing resources without you having to worry too much about load balancing and making sure making sure all the cores on your system are busy doing work that's useful to you. That's what Concert is good for. At the end of the day, if there's one thing I'd like you to get out of this presentation and the capabilities of the concurrency runtime is that the programming models we expose allow you to express your potential concurrency. It's Concert's job to map that potential currency to what's available on your particular machine. And what you should expect from that is if you have a single core machine, you can still write your program using the concurrency runtime and it will still run on a single core machine. But if you bring it to a two-core machine, you hope that your operation runs twice as fast. Four cores, four times as fast, all the way up to 256 cores, as I explained in the last slide. So, with that, I'm going to start by talking about something that has nothing to do with concurrency. but has everything to do with making our programming model that we expose usable. And that's the biggest one is lambdas. This is a new feature in what's called C++ OX, which is the next version of the standard. It's part of the standard, so it's not a Microsoft-specific extension. And all it does is generate code for you. If you look at the left-hand side of this this slide, that's the lambda version. That generates the right-hand side. It's just syntactic sugar, but I think you'll agree that it's a lot easier to write the left-hand side than the right-hand side. So if you've never seen a lambda before in C++, it's very similar to an anonymous delegate in C# or VB. Lambda is introduced by what I have in square brackets, the X and amper Y. That's a lambda introducer. And what that does is manage the captured state from the surrounding scope. So my lambda body there, my function body there, is going to reference X and Y from the surrounding scope, so I have to capture them. And this is what's really powerful if you're used to anonymous delegates in C#. You can specify how things get captured in C++. You have a lot of control, which is really helpful. In particular, you can be very mindful of how you capture things. So note that my lambda is updating Y, so I better capture it by reference, which is what amper Y signifies. And I'm only going to be reading from X, so I don't have to capture it by reference. I just capture it by value. So it lets you be very mindful of what you capture in a lambda and how you access it, which is very important for concurrency. So lambdas make functional programming pretty easy. In C++, for a long time now, I don't know if you're aware of it, there's this algorithms library, which, it, for example, has something called std4each, which operates over a range of iterators over an STL collection. And I think you can see that if you use a lambda to specify the function that each element is to operate on each element, it's much cleaner syntactically to use a lambda now, because this for each function now starts to look an awful lot like a first class for loop in C++. So it really goes a long way to making programming models, and not just our concurrent programming model, easier to use. So I'm going to start talking about concurrency right now. So I showed you for each. One easy way to get your code to run in parallel is to identify serial loops that have no loop iteration dependencies or shared state in them, and make that loop operate in parallel. In other words, you can say each iteration of this loop can potentially run in parallel. So we have added in the concurrency runtime at the PPL layer, parallel pattern library layer, something called parallel for, which the lambda syntax now makes really, really friendly. So in parallel for, we adopt the pattern that you typically see in for loops, where you go for I equals 0 to 1,000. I is equal to 0, I less than 1,000, and then do your loop body. In other words, that loop body does not include 1,000. It goes from 0 to 999. So that's the semantics we've adopted for parallel for as well. And in this case, you identified that the work on each iteration is independent and can potentially be run on its own core. In addition, in this particular loop, I've expressed a potential parallelism of 1,000. In other words, if I have 1,000 cores, I could potentially do all this stuff each on its own core. Now, as I said earlier in the introduction, you probably don't have 1,000 cores. You probably have 4. So leave it up to the concurrency runtime to bundle up units of iterations and spread it around your cores equally. So from a high level, I'm going to show you approximately how parallel for works. And it's actually pretty complicated. There are some nuances, and this isn't the exact picture. But I hope it's enough to at least give you a mental model of how it works. So I'm going to use the example of going from 0 to 1,000. I have 1,000 iterations, and I have 4 cores. So, a simple way to manage the splitting of the work among all the processes is just to split the iterations into fourths. So 250 goes to core 0, 250 go to core 1, and to core 2, and to core 3. That works pretty well. I do want to add some caveats that there's, because of the algorithm that the underlying concurrency runtime does, it's not true that you can guarantee that the first 250 elements go to core 0. Maybe it's the third 250 elements that go to core 0. It's kind of a random assignment. You can't really be sure. The other thing is that cores may come and go. You may have four cores on your system, but, and this is a strength of concurrency runtime, what if somewhere else in your program, running on another thread, concurrently, you have another parallel 4 operating from 0 to 1,000? In other words, you have two parallel 4 loops running in parallel. So what you don't want and what you're not going to get because the concurrency runtime manages this is two threads running on, two operations, each thinking they own the machine, running all four, their operation on all four cores on eight threads. See, what you don't want is this situation where you have eight threads running simultaneously on four cores. That's called oversubscription. I don't know about you, but when my brain gets preempted, I get less work done in a day, not more. So it's much better that I can do one task, finish it, and then go do the next task. So Concert manages this pretty well, actually very well and very fairly. So what would happen in that case is you have four tasks running because you have two parallel fours, but probably only two threads. In other words, you'll only have four running at any one time, and then when they're done, they'll pick up work from whatever's available, whatever the next thing is available. So we're trying to be fair and balanced. The other nuance is that the work done in each iteration is not necessarily a uniform length. In other words, I might have an if statement that says, you know, if something is true, I'm going to do some very quick processing. Else, I'm going to need to do some very expensive processing. And when you have a situation like that, it may happen that core 2, for example, gets lucky and gets a lot of the iterations where it only had to do a little bit of stuff. In other words, it gets finished early and it has no work to do. And in that case, there's a protocol in parallel 4 which says, the core that just finished all its work says, hey, I'm available. It'll communicate with one of the other cores and say, do you have any work for me to do? And it'll negotiate some range stealing mechanism whereby, you know, core 3 might still have 100 iterations to do. So it'll send 50 of them to core 2. Core 3 will continue on with 50. And that way, all four cores are busy doing your useful work. One of them just isn't idle sitting there doing nothing when it could be doing useful work. So I've mentioned some of this before in that previous slide. Parallel 4, the one we provide in the parallel pattern library, is designed to be very flexible and to handle a lot of varying kinds of workloads, including this unbalanced loop body situation that I just described. Another thing that the parallel 4 algorithm in our PPL supports is cancellation. So you may be operating over doing a parallel 4 over a range and searching for something. And if you find it, you just want to break out. Well, you can't break out of a lambda because a lambda is a function. So you have to cancel. So I'm not going to go into the details, but there is a cancel protocol where you can tell the concurrency runtime to cancel this for loop. Don't start any new iterations that haven't been started. When the ones that are currently running finish, just terminate them. So parallel 4 is designed to handle that too. All of this does add overhead to parallel 4. We try and minimize the overhead, but you know the flexibility that we offer does add to the overhead. So if you're mindful of how of what the contents of your loop bodies are, and you decide that you don't need cancellation, and that the amount of work done in each iteration is approximately equal, then we have a sample pack that you can just download from the internet, and we have something called Parallel 4 Fixed. And Parallel 4 Fixed, if you go back to the previous, I'll go back to the previous slide, whoops, really is almost as simple as this diagram. I'm going to divide my work up into 250 iterations, spread them around my four cores, and just let them run. There's no protocol for stealing or anything like that. Another tip for parallelizing things is to parallelize the outer loop first. Again, there is overhead associated with parallel 4. So one way to mitigate this overhead is to make your loop parallel 4 loop body fairly chunky. There's a trade-off there that you have to be aware of. If you make it too chunky, you reduce the opportunity to do this load balancing that I talked about. But if you don't make it chunky enough, then the amount of work you do in parallel is not enough to overcome the overhead of sending stuff to another thread, synchronizing, etc. So you have to be pretty mindful. So the best way, one of the best ways to do that is if you have this double nested loop or triple nested loop situation, try parallelizing the outer one first. I mean, in this case, this is an example of a Mandelbrot on a 2D window. So if you take a typical window size, it might be 1,000 in the Y direction. By parallelizing in the Y direction, what I've said is each line can be processed in parallel. And again, you probably don't have 1,000 cores. It'll map to 4 or 8 or 16. If you do magically happen to have 1,000 cores, you can probably parallelize this inner loop too. That's another thing that the concurrency runtime handles pretty well, is nested parallelism. See, but then, if you have, you know, approximately 1,000 in the X direction, you basically have specified a potential parallelism of 1,000,000. If you have 1,000,000 cores, you could do 1 pixel per core. You probably don't. Again, Concert will map that to the available concurrency. And it'll probably be okay in this case. It probably will, the body of the inner loop is probably still meaty enough in this case to overcome the overhead. But it is something that you have to think about. You have to take some care when applying these parallel 4 algorithms. So I promised you that I would show you that N-bodies demo that I showed you the video of at the beginning of the session. Here's the code. And it's not all the code. It doesn't show the gravitational interaction or the real computations, because that's not interesting in this case. But you can see that the top function, N-body CPU, is just a for loop that goes over all the particles. And the bottom loop is the parallelization of that. Parallel 4. Each particle is independent of the other ones. And that's all I had to do to achieve that dramatic improvement that you saw. So in the same vein of parallel 4, it's often the case that you are iterating over a collection of items. This is C++. We really like STL. So you could be iterating over a vector or a list or a std array or dec, if you use that one. So this is just similar to parallel 4, only instead of operating over an integer range, it operates over a range of iterators, just like the std for each that I showed you earlier with the lambda example. It's exactly the same. All the work happens in parallel for each element in the collection. Now, parallel for each works best with collections that support random access iterators. In other words, if they're array-like. Vector, you can access any element just by specifying the index of it. Std array, dec, I peeked ahead here to the concurrent vector, which we provide in the concurrency runtime as well. It still works, even for things that only support forward iteration, like std list or std map. It doesn't work as well. There's more overhead. Chances are your work in each loop body needs to be chunkier in order to overcome the overhead that you're going to pay for that. But it does still work. So now I'm going to talk about shared state. In the examples that I've showed you so far, the work inside parallel for each, is what we call embarrassingly parallel. In other words, there's no shared state, and the loop iterations don't depend on each other. I don't depend on the work of a previous iteration before I can continue to a subsequent iteration. There's nothing embarrassing about embarrassingly parallel. You want to be there, by the way. So here's an example that has some shared state, and I drew a big X through it because you'd never want to do this. The first thing I'm doing in this loop body is I'm going to take a critical section because I'm going to update some shared state, the sum that I'm computing. This is a horrible thing to do. I don't know why you'd ever do it, because for every iteration, there's going to be contention on that critical section. It's going to essentially serialize the loop. Also, there's a chance that you could get a thread explosion because concert is cooperative, which means that if it detects that a thread blocks, it will try to create a new thread to handle any tasks that you may have in the queue, which might then immediately block, which might cause concert to create a new thread, and you could potentially get a thread explosion this way. We do have a throttling mechanism, but this is a real anti-pattern, so you don't want to do this. The simple way to reduce contention is to shrink the size of the critical section. In fact, I could shrink it even further from how I've shown here by just putting it around the addition of the sum. But in this case, if the condition that's protecting this critical section is true a lot, we're back to the previous picture. So there's a worse case still. So here's a solution that turns this situation back into an embarrassingly parallel situation. It's called combinable. And basically the trick here is, if you have shared state and it's causing you scalability problems, then get rid of the shared state. And combinable can, in many circumstances, let you do that, because what you do with combinable, or what combinable does for you, is it creates a local copy per thread. In other words, you're a thread, you have your very own copy, and you can do updates to it without any kind of synchronization at all. But at the end of the parallel for loop, I don't have one sum anymore. I have eight on my eight-core machine. I have eight sums. In other words, I have to take those sub-computations and then combine them into the master computation. So that's why it's called combinable. That's why I'm calling the combine method on the sums object with the plus functor. In other words, it's just going to add them all up and produce my final sum. There's no contention at all, and there's no cache. It's a cache-friendly solution because combinable takes great care to make sure that each thread local copy is on its own cache line. I'm going to actually show you right now a dramatic, I think, example of that. So, close that. So, what I'm going to do in this example is compute from 0 to, I think, 15,000, all the pairs from 0 to 15,000, whether the pairs of numbers are relatively prime. And that's just a simple greatest common denominator computation. They're relatively prime if they have a greatest common denominator of 1. So let me run this. Now, this is live, so this is where I pray to the demo gods. So first, I'm going to run the serial version, and I'm actually going to go back to the code. It probably shouldn't affect the timing very much. But here's the code. There's a doubly nested loop, and for each pair, I'm going to compute whether they're relatively prime. And if they are, I'm going to update a shared count. So I don't have to worry about shared state in my serial version. Where did it go?
Scroll down.
Yeah, but where'd my window go? There. Okay, thank you. And let me get Task Manager up here, too, because that's interesting. Huh? I want to be on the remote desktop.
Yeah, you're not now.
Why aren't I? There we go. Thank you. All right. If you forgive me, I won't bother them. There we go. Okay. So, the next thing I'm going to do here is my first weak attempt to parallelize this, I'm just going to turn my for loop into a parallel for. You know, but oops, I'm going to do a non-thread safe update to my shared variable. And let's see what kind of... Well, I am scrolling around a lot. Let's see what kind of effect that has. I might expect it to go faster, but I do expect that it'll give the wrong answer. But in fact, as we watch this come back, it is a little faster, but it's very disappointingly faster. It's really not much faster at all. And it gave me the wrong answer to add insult to injury. So to protect this, I have the same code, but my plus plus count here is protected by a critical section. And this is going to take a long time because I'm in that situation that I showed on that slide earlier where everything is serialized. You can see that I'm barely able to get 30% of my total CPU capacity. This is an 8-core machine. I'm barely able to get 30%, and in fact, I'm less than half as fast as the serial version. So that wasn't good. So another solution is instead of using a heavyweight critical section, you can use interlocked increment. Let me show... Whoops, where'd that go? If I do that, at least I expect the right answer, but I think I'm going to get a similar performance to the unlocked version. In other words, it's a disappointing speed up. And the reason for the disappointing speed up is that in both the unlocked case and this case, I'm thrashing the cache like crazy. I have 8 cores all trying to update the same cache line. It's constantly being invalidated, flushed, reloaded, and it's killing my scalability. So finally, here's my combinable version of it. It's just like the slide. Instead of one count, I have a combinable of counts. So now each thread is going to do an update to a local copy. It's the first thing I'm going to do here is grab my local copy. And then in my inner loop, I only have to update my thread safe private copy. And then at the end, at the end of the parallel for, just combine the results. So if I do that one, I am able to achieve 100% of my CPU. Actually, that went really quick, almost too quick to measure. But you can see that I solved my shared state problem. I reduced my problem to a virtually embarrassing version of it. And I got close to 8x speed up, which is what I really want to see on my 8x system. Okay. So, Daniel will kill me if I don't do this. I'm going to show you some of the debugging features of Visual Studio 2010 that relate to parallelism, and I can get rid of my task manager now. So I'm going to go back, and I'm going to run this locked version again, this one here. I'm just going to run it. Now, if I stop here, I'm inside the critical section. Probably have to scroll around a lot. The first thing I'm going to show you, debug, Windows... is the parallel tasks window. So here, I can see that I have all these tasks running on the system that the debugger knows about. And right now they're just ordered by ID. I can sort things by status or task group. I've got the little yellow arrow that shows the current one. And in fact, you can, for a better view, you can actually do a group by on them. And you can see that I have 5 running tasks here and 3 waiting tasks here. So if I hover over these waiting tasks, you can see that there's a problem here just by this tooltip. This task is waiting. It's blocked. And what's it blocked on? It's blocked on a critical section. That critical section is owned by thread 1528. Well, 1528 is obviously the one that I'm running on because I stopped it right in the middle of that critical section. So I can see that I have a contention on this. And if I, well, if I run, you know, and I stop and I see a snapshot like this, I can see that I have a lot of contention because I have a lot of waiting tasks. This is wasted CPU. So the other one is the parallel stacks. So this is the thread view, which is really, really the only one that I can see here is the main thread there. But if I drag it around, I can see basically what all the threads in the system are doing. And I can maybe identify the ones that are operating on my Lambda here. It's probably this one. I have 8 threads operating on my Lambda. Now, this is a threads view. There's a tasks view as well. So this collapses it down to a much more manageable set. So now I can see that I actually have 9 tasks running my Lambda, my parallel 4. Turns out 7 of them are waiting, so only 2 of them are actually running useful work. Whoops. So well, I think I'm done with that anyway. All right. So I'm going to take a moment to talk about asynchronous agents. I think I only have about 7 minutes or so, so I might have to go pretty fast through this. I apologize. The parallel iteration was a way to map loops into parallelism, but not all programming patterns map that way. Sometimes you have pipelines in your code or state machines, or you know, the most common one is producer-consumer. This is declarative parallelism, and asynchronous agents lets you program that at a very high level. It also helps solve the shared state issue, because to program with asynchronous agents, you have to adopt a discipline of no shared state. You pass state to another agent by sending a message. That message that receives that data takes ownership of it. So you basically break out of the whole shared state jail if you use messaging and agents. So an agent is simply an asynchronous object, and you communicate between them using message passing. And we provide some message blocks out of the box that handle messages and pass them on in special ways. And a message is just data. So the asynchronous agents library has message blocks out of the box. Unbounded buffer is just a queue. So you send a message, it goes to the front of the queue. You receive a message, you receive it from the back of the queue. And it's unbounded, so it's only limited by your available memory. We have overwrite buffer. You send a message. If somebody else sends a message, it'll overwrite the previous one. So you always get the latest copy. And you have single assignment, which is somebody sends a message, somebody sends another message. Well, it's too late. That second message and all subsequent messages get discarded. You have blocks for synchronizing. So you have a message block that can take several inputs and propagate forward the first one that it received. Or wait till you have all your inputs and propagate forward a tuple that contains all your message data. And we have some message blocks that do computations on data as it passes through the pipeline. We have a transformer, which basically transforms from, you know, T to U, some type T to U, or does some processing on the message. It doesn't even have to change types. Or you can have a call, which is basically the terminus of a message pipeline. at the end of this, you get a piece of data and you do some computation on it. And you can send synchronously or asynchronously, and you can receive synchronously or asynchronously. So here's a simple example. I have two agents signified by the yellow circles. The first agent is just going to send a string to an unbounded buffer that's running in another agent. And that unbounded buffer is going to propagate the message to a transformer. In this case, the transformer is going to do a simple reversal of the string. It could do something more useful than that, but it's just an example. And we're going to receive that message. We should get the string in reverse. So the code for that looks like this. I'm probably not going to have time to show the demo, but it's not that impressive anyway. The agent derives from concurrency agent. I have 5 minutes. And it has message blocks as members. So it has the reverser transformer as a private member and has an unbounded buffer, which is it's exposing publicly for the other agent to communicate with it. And the reverse agent initializes its transformer using a lambda. So lambdas really help in the agents library to specify your functionality without having to write your own function objects. So in this case, this lambda is going to take a string in and take a copy of it, reverse it, and return it. And the constructor to my reverse agent is also going to link the two message blocks. So the input buffer is going to be linked to the reverser, so there'll be an automatic propagation from one to the other. And of course, each agent needs to override the run method. And for the run method in this guy, he's just going to sit in an infinite loop, receive a message from the reversed message block, and if he gets a stop message, which of course is reversed, is POTS, he's going to call done, that's part of the protocol, and return. Otherwise, he's just going to print out his message. And the other side, the sending side of it, is just as simple. So first of all, we have to start the receiving agent, and then we're just sitting in a loop sending messages. So you get a string from input. A copy of it is sent to the reverser agent. Ownership of the message is transferred. There's no shared state. And again, if I get stop here, I have to terminate. And because we're in main here, I have to wait for my reverse agent to terminate because it's on the stack, and I'll get weird memory errors if I don't. So I'm going to skip the demo because I don't have much time, and I'm probably going to have to end on this slide here. So in addition to the two programming models, PPL and agents, we also provide two concurrent lock-free containers. It's another way of managing shared state is to use self-synchronized containers that are safe to use in parallel. These are safe and scalable because they're lock-free. One is the concurrent vector, which allows for concurrent pushback and accumulation of state in parallel. Note that there's no remove or erase function on this. It turns out to be very difficult to do that in a non-garbage collected system. And the other one is concurrent queue, which is really great for producer-consumer scenarios because you can have one thread pushing data and another thread dequeuing data, and it's all in parallel, and it's all self-synchronized in a very scalable and lock-free way. We also have something in the sample pack that adds two more, actually three more, I think. There's a concurrent unordered map and concurrent set, and then there might be one more. But they're all based on the concurrent unordered map. So this lets you manage sets of data in parallel. I think that's all I have time for, so I'll stick around for Q&A. When we're all done, please exit through the exit that way. And thank you for coming to my presentation, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the track.
Question for you. How are exceptions propagated across the concurrency runtime threads?
Who's asking the question? Oh, there you go. Okay, that's a good question. That's another thing that C++ OX introduced and Visual Studio 2010 supports is exception marshaling. So if you're in a parallel loop, for example, and you throw an exception, you can catch it from outside the parallel loop because the concurrency runtime and the underlying C runtime will marshal that exception to the main thread, and you can catch it just like an ordinary exception.
Hey, Don.
Hi, Pedro.
Two questions. Well, one of the things that happens a lot with ThreadPool is that even though this represents a totally different model of task-oriented programming, people tend to end up thinking of these as threads. I know that the sugarcoating on the C++ makes it a little bit distant, but what I'm considering is what happens when how do you specify the initial environment for the threads that you create to run these work items? And I'm talking about the size of the stack, the priority, the co-initialized, the calm state of these threads. And how do you deal with work items that even may pollute these threads, like call set a priority and not reverse, impersonate and not reverse?
Right. Those are excellent questions. We don't have solutions for many of those. So in terms of co-initialize and co-uninitialize, we take the approach that we own the threads. And we're the ones that are going to do the initialization, or in your case, fail to do the initialization. And if you want to do any COM stuff, you'll have to basically co-initialize and then uninitialize in each task, which is going to be expensive. So this is something that's not well suited to use in concert, and I'll just come right out and say that.
Okay.
I'm sorry, what was the first part of your question again?
That was it. How do you initialize the environment?
Oh, okay.
I mean, how do you choose for the stack size?
You said stack size. We actually do have policies that you can create your scheduler, initialize your scheduler, and set the stack size. And we have a notion of priorities if you want to control that as well. But if you go around impersonating, you have to revert, or else you're just going to pollute the next task. You have to deal with that.
Another one. This is very simple. Can we use parallel four, but not the concert runtime? What I mean is, apparently, when you use parallel four, you kind of end up specifying a lambda for that thing that it's going to run in parallel, and then you're going to submit internally all these work items as these lambdas to your runtime. Can we specify a different alternative runtime that picks these up?
No.
They're hardwired?
No, they're hardwired to concert, and the reason that they're hardwired to concert is that they're designed to cooperate with each other. In particular, the agents model, those cooperate with loop bodies, parallel loop bodies. You know, the concert makes sure that only one of them is running on a core at any one time, so you minimize oversubscription.
Sweet. Thanks.
Okay.
So I have two questions about concert, if I may. The first one is, I think you implied in your presentation that you explicitly try to set thread affinity to different cores. Why do you need to do that instead? Just leave the operating system's task scheduler to do that.
So I'll answer that by saying that we do the affinitization fairly weakly. And what we end up doing, in fact, this may change from release to release, is to affinitize to sockets or nodes. And then let the OS decide within a node how things get scheduled. But by us managing the affinitization, at least to the node, you can potentially have some guarantee that your tasks and the memory your tasks access are close to the node that they're going to be scheduled on. There's a lower level programming model that can let you divide your tasks into schedule groups, they're called, and that's kind of a locality mechanism that we have built in that lets you keep work that's related close to each other on the theory that they're accessing memory that's close as well.
So my second question is, You mentioned that you're trying to be fair when splitting time among tasks. Are you also trying to be fair to other threads that do not explicitly use the framework, you know, just simultaneously running?
No. If you create threads outside of the Concert runtime, we don't know about them. So they'll compete. And in fairness, so you probably have other processes running on your system too. We have no notion of what's going on there. So although we try and minimize oversubscription, it's going to be there. All we can do is within a process.
Hey, it's great to see concurrent containers, but like the best place to be is immutable. Like, will there be any immutable data structures added to standard library?
Immutable data structures, can you give me an example?
Well, like the way F-sharp does it, when you have a queue, but adding an item to a queue produces a new version of that queue instead of modifying.
The closest thing we have to that is our message passing model. You do pass data through a pipeline, and at each stage in there, a copy is made. So, once a message is sent through a pipeline, it is mutable. Nobody will ever change it again.
But that creates a copy of the whole data structure,
yeah.
Which is like immutable data structures in F-sharp and many other languages solve it by creating only copying what needs to be copied.
Yeah.
So it's way more efficient.
The closest thing to that in C++ OX, this has nothing to do with concurrency again, is the move semantics. A lot of the containers, STL containers in C++ now support move semantics, where you do get a copy of the structure, but you may not necessarily have to deeply copy everything that's contained in there. And that's a mechanism, you can opt into that, and we'll support that insofar as when you copy stuff, you'll use the move constructor. That's, I think, as close as we'll get to that in C++.
Thank you.
There's one back there.
I'm wondering if do you control L2 caches in any form? For instance, in some architectures, you may have multiple L2 caches with several cores sharing one L2 cache. And so when you schedule tasks, like if one task computed something and it's in L2 cache number one, makes sense. And if there's like n tasks that wants to access that data, it makes sense to schedule it on that core. Do you control it in any form or not?
So the truthful answer to that is no. Now, we do try to be cache-friendly. So, for example, we will basically, if you pile a bunch of tasks into Concert, we will eventually migrate them to cores and to sockets. And when each thread running on a current socket is looking for new work, it will look locally. It'll look for work close to it on the theory that it's going to be accessing data that's warm in your L1, L2, whatever hierarchy of cache you have. If it doesn't find anything locally, it'll steal from another socket and pay for the huge cache miss because it needs to keep busy. It's better to keep busy than to be idle in that case. In the next version of Concert, I believe there will be a richer way to specify locality of things and give you greater control about what things run together. Because right now, the answer is it's pretty weak and it's pretty heuristic. All right. Oh, question down here.
Is this built on top of the UMS API?
Ah, good question. Concert in Visual Studio 2010 does support UMS. You have to opt into it. So by default, it will use the ordinary Win32 threads as the underlying threading mechanism. On Win7 64-bit, a UMS-capable system, it will support UMS. And, of course, the benefit you get from that is basically every blocking operation is a cooperative blocking operation. So we could potentially keep the cores busier on Win7 64-bit. Right behind you.
So one of the problems you might run into with scheduling here is both potentially an oversubscription of CPU, but also memory. Do you have anything interesting from the operating system to throttle the total number of threads that are created machine-wide based on both memory and CPU demands?
Certainly nothing machine-wide. CPU-wide, process-wide, we do have a mechanism to throttle, and an improved mechanism will be coming in Visual Studio 11. But in Visual Studio 2010, we also have some throttling mechanisms that prevent, in most cases, a runaway thread explosion like I described during my presentation. There's also an underlying resource manager that arbitrates requests for threads, for cores, among competing schedulers, because you can have more than one scheduler in concert. And in fact, you can have different kinds of schedulers, because Intel, TVB, and OpenMP is using our resource manager to arbitrate those requests. So if you have TVB or Intel's OpenMP in the same process as Concert, it'll try to be fair and arbitrate the available resources between them. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate you all coming out.